What is up, BHB family? This is Coach Coop here with another episode of BHB Radio. Tonight, my guest is Craig Emmerich. You guys might know he and his wife, Maria. We're actually going to interview her pretty soon here as well. They are ancestral health and keto chefs, authors, best-selling authors. In fact, they actually have a book coming out with none other than Halle Berry. Craig is incredibly versatile in his knowledge, and tonight we're going to get into nutrition for sleep, nutrition for brain power. We're going to get into how babies are born in a state of ketosis and their developing brains love ketones, address the question of whether or not the brain's favorite fuel is actually ketones. We're going to get into what's up with the carnivore diet, who should do it, if that is something or a tree that we should be barking up in the first place, or perhaps even temporarily. We're going to get into nutrient-dense foods. We're going to get into how well the brain can perform on ketones, if ketones can relieve anxiety, sleep hacks that everyone can do pretty simply to improve their sleep right away. Tonight's episode is brought to you by Real Ketones. Be sure to check out realketones.com for everything that you need with the highest quality supplements, including a full line of exogenous ketones and keto support supplements like the Keto Support Multivitamin. In addition to that, they also have a treasure trove of education fully live on the site and accessible to anyone. So you not only are getting a high grade of supplements, you're also getting everything you need to get started and make the process of getting healthy and fit as easy as possible. Without further ado, let's get this show on the road. Good evening, everyone. This is Coach Matt, and you are listening to Better Health and Body Radio, your source for the latest and greatest information and understanding in the world of health, nutrition, and performance, where we give you a seat at the table next to the best and the brightest minds to arm you with the information you need to optimize yourself. Join us for another exciting, thought-provoking episode of BHB Radio, starting now. All right, Craig, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm really thankful that I've been able to interview both you and Maria. It's like the power couple of guests that I've had on the show. So I think the audience, myself, everybody's going to learn a lot. I can't wait.
Well, thanks again. Thanks for your kind words.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I'm familiar with you guys and your work, but for people at home who might not be, do you mind introducing yourself to everybody?
Sure. My name is Craig Emmerich, and my wife, Maria, and I have published, I think she's got over 20 books now on nutrition and health and cookbooks, you know, about low sugar, grain-free cooking, whether you want to call that keto or carnivore, all the different subsets there are of that kind of low carb style of eating. I personally started out in electrical engineering. And so this is kind of a segue that happened about, 10, 12 years ago with her business. I was kind of the guy behind the scenes, keeping websites running and all that kind of stuff. And when her business grew enough, it just made sense for me to step away and commit to our own business. And that enabled us to both kind of dive into this. And then I actually started co-authoring books with her, our keto book and our carnivore book and our upcoming sugar-free kids book. I wrote parts of the front sections, or like in the keto book, I wrote about half of that book about biology and how the bodies work and all that. So, kind of in full board now with the business.
Very nice. Very nice. Oh, that's great to hear. So just, you kind of hit on a couple things that I think are really useful for people to hear. So you guys have a book coming out on sugar-free cooking for kids, right?
Yeah. Yep. Coming out in August.
Awesome. Awesome. And is there any general information that you think that parents listening should know about, you know, what happens when they give their kids refined sugar?
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the things I thought was really, and when I started to dive into the research of this, and, you know, this is the electrical engineer coming out, right? Like, electrical engineering is one of those fields where if you aren't studying on the latest information and science, 6 months, you're practically obsolete in your field, you know. Wow. So electronics and computer chips, everything's changing so fast. And with new technologies coming out and everything. And so I kind of have kept a lot of that. And I'm always diving into subjects, you know, deep diving into the science whenever different aspects come up. And when we were writing this kid's book, one of the things I started looking into was, you know, everybody universally says breast milk is the best food for a baby, right? There's nobody that denies that, right?
Right, right.
Well, you start looking at breast milk and say, okay, what's it made up of? And it's got a lot of saturated fat in it. And it also has a lot of protein. And there are carbs too. But if you look at it from a breakdown and how much a newborn baby actually consumes, they're getting like almost three times their lean mass in protein per day. So if you look at their lean mass, you know, they're probably like 6-7 pounds of lean mass. They're getting, you know, almost 20 grams of protein from the breast milk, like three times their lean mass. And adults, you typically say like 0.8 times your lean mass for your protein goal. So you can see when kids are in this growth state, when they're young, they need a lot of protein to fuel growth. Because what builds cells, what builds, you know, amino acids are the building blocks of the body, right? And so when the body's growing so rapidly, like in kids, you need a lot of protein. And there's also a lot of saturated fat, which is a very stable fat, which helps fuel the growth and brain development of the baby. You look at a baby's brain, it's huge compared to the size of its body. I think our brains only grow like I wrote it in the book, but I can't remember the exact percentage that it actually grows from a baby to an adult, but it's like a quarter of the growth of the rest of the body. And so when they're that small, the brain is this massive energy hog. And so that's why you need all the fuels you can get, right? And also you want to fatten them up a little bit to give them some resiliency, right? As a baby, if winter hits, you know, evolutionary speaking. So that's why it has high carbs and high fat, because it's trying to fatten them up. It's trying to supply fuel for this massive brain that it has compared to the size of its body. And actually a baby will, even given all of that, a baby that's breastfeeding is in ketosis. Its blood ketones are 0.5 at when it's fed. And when it hasn't been fed for like an hour or two, they're like 2 or 3. And so a baby is eating lots of protein. They're getting lots of saturated fat and they're in a state of ketosis as a newborn. Wow. So when you look at that and you say, okay, now transition from that to what, right? And when does that stop being the healthiest diet possible for this baby? And suddenly you're supposed to switch to like peas and carrot purees with no fat, no protein. And, you know, if you look at baby food as a whole, it's an abomination of almost no protein, almost no fat. And it's almost a vegetarian diet that you're switching to if you go to baby food. How does that jive? Like that's the thing that shocked me the most when we were writing this.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, I didn't know that. I hadn't heard that before. I think I had heard like maybe someone had said it off the cuff and then you're bringing it back now. I'd never really looked into it. So you're saying that, yeah, you know, babies, I don't know if born into that state is necessarily the right word, but babies actually are spending plenty of time on a spectrum of ketosis, it sounds like you're saying, right?
Yeah, well, they are the entire time from birth through breastfeeding until basically you switch off of breast milk. And then that's when the kids will start transitioning out of that, depending on what you feed them, right? If you feed them the baby foods, yeah, things will change and they'll start primarily running on sugar because that's all they're getting,
right?
Or, you know, carbohydrates. Because one of the charts I put in our book just showed like four of the most popular baby foods. One was like, I don't know, peas and peaches and organic peas and peaches. And another one's like these, you know, banana, these little Fruit Loop things that kids chew on and play with. And there's one other one, and all of them had zero fat and all of them had zero protein. And most of the vitamins and minerals in it were fortified, so they just added a multivitamin, and then it's got a bunch of sugar and carbs. And you compare that to just real food, and I actually made a chart comparing the nutrients, the vitamins and minerals in those foods compared to just eggs or a steak, beef. Like, beef blows it out of the water. There's so many more vitamins and minerals in addition to the protein that they need to thrive and is healthy saturated fat that their brains are striving for. So it's really a stark contrast when you look at it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. That's wild. And I hadn't thought of that from, a macronutrient perspective before. Do our, you know, the formulas that are out there, do those really match up with what's, you know, more or less ideal? And it's probably just because that's not necessarily the client base that I tend to work with, but that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I was already aware of the fact that there was a lot of possible additives and maybe non-bioavailable nutrients and things like that in there. So that's interesting. So you guys are with this book are actually helping people usher in a state of ideal nutrition or something closer to it from a younger age that hopefully can give them a lot of benefits, not only then, but set them up for like a long, healthy, happy, fit life.
Yeah, exactly. The brain is filled with fat and cholesterol. Like, it's the biggest source of cholesterol in the body. And yet we transition these kids to a fat-free diet with these baby foods. It really makes no sense at all. And, kids need protein to thrive. They need fat to thrive and they need some carbs. But if you've got enough fat around, you don't need all that many carbs, because that's, if you look at the body as in general, and this is kind of back to kind of a biology standpoint, right? If you look at what would be my body's preferred fuel, fat or carbohydrates, right? If you look at it from the perspective of storage capacity, wouldn't it supply itself with a much bigger storage capacity of the preferred fuel than the not so much preferred fuel, right?
Yeah, I follow what you're saying logically.
Wouldn't that make sense? Like, if you had an electric hybrid car and the battery could only take you 50 miles, but the gas tank could take you 500, but all you did was run off the electric battery all the time and kept recharging it and never tapped the gas engine, kind of wouldn't make too much sense, right? And with the body, it's kind of the same. You can only store like 1500 calories to maybe 2000 in glycogen, depending on your size. So you have 1500 to 2000 calories of glycogen sitting there, and fat is theoretically unlimited. I mean, we have a client we're working with right now. He was 645 pounds when he started, and he's already lost over 125 pounds. But think about how many calories of fat that is stored on his body that he's got, you know, access to. So theoretically, you have unlimited storage for fat, and then this real small storage tank for glucose. So in my mind, that says fat is really the preferred fuel of the body.
Right, right. Yeah, I totally hear what you're saying. I think too, one way to look at that is like the analogy you gave, which is like a hybrid. And I try to get people to think about being able to use each fuel system depending on, you know, their activity level, when they need it, right? Like, you and I are talking right now, and assuming neither of us is like anxious and breathing heavy, our primary fuel is going to be the body fat that we have, right? And or dietary fat. Whereas if you and I were to go out sprinting or like your average person just go to the gym and lift weights or something like that, then that's going to be something more akin to using that glycogen, that precious glycogen that we have, like, as you put it, in smaller reserves in our system.
Yeah. You know, and if you can look at it from an evolutionary perspective as well in that context. And yeah, the glycogen is really intended to be more of the kind of fight or flight fuel, where fat is kind of everything else. You know,
right.
The if people think that, you know, oh, I went on a like long two, you know, brisk, you know, hour long walk or 2 hour long walk, and so now I can, you know, tap up my glycogen stores with a, you know, high carb meal or something. You didn't even tap into that glycogen on even a brisk 2 hour walk. Like, that glycogen in your muscles is locked away for that intense you know, need, whether you're sprinting or you're doing, you know, working out at a very high, you know, activity level for an extended period, like a marathon runner or something like that. Like your typical, you know, brisk walk or those type of exercises will never tap into that muscle glycogen. So it's really locked up for that, you know, fight or flight need moment.
Exactly. Exactly. I'm glad you said that too. Just in general and regarding the fight or flight response, right? Because they've actually done metabolic testing in labs and found that people, they basically, if they're stressed out, they're actually burning, you know, more carbohydrates. So I think, you know, what's ideal to pull away from that too, is when people are craving sugar, carbs, sometimes like that, it could be because they are just generally more stressed people. And that could be kind of a canary in the coal mine for what's going on under the hood. That's great. Totally. This is all great information.
Yeah, totally. And you know, another thing that really leads into that is sleep. And we are very big proponents of getting enough sleep when, especially when weight loss is the goal, because, you know, again, not getting enough sleep can raise cortisol. It can, you know, do all the things you described. It drives a lot more hunger during the day when you don't get enough sleep. You know, all of these things from the hormones that are affected by sleep is huge. And so we make sure everybody gets at least 8 to 9 hours of good sleep.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, I think most people too, it's like they tend to focus on nutrition and training and they kind of tend to neglect sleep. I mean, I think that's, you know, something that we're understanding more and more about as every, you know, new study, new technology to monitor it with every passing year. Right. But I still think that's the one that most people think they can kind of shortchange and still get away with their results. They're almost
praised sometimes, you know, they're praised if they're this hard worker and they only sleep, you know, 5 or 6 hours and they work long hours and all that, you know, it's almost praised that you only get 5 hours of sleep.
Right. And yeah, and it is funny too, because some people will swear up and down that they can function well on such a light amount of sleep and less hours of sleep. However, I mean, I think that there's a difference between surviving and thriving, and the people who maybe have some sort of genetic lottery that they won where they can function on a little less sleep pretty well. How much better could they be if they got quality sleep, right? How much more body fat could you lose? How much more energy could you have for yourself throughout your own, you know, your day, your life? How much lean body mass could you hang on to or possibly build if you were dialing in your sleep well too?
Totally. Yeah. 100% on that.
On that note, do you have any tips you'd recommend for people at home to help dial in their sleep?
Yeah. Typically we kind of break things into two groups. One is, you know, people that have trouble falling asleep. And then the other group is, you know, people that fall asleep okay, but then, you know, they wake up at like 2 a.m. and bing, they're wide awake and they can't fall back asleep. Those two groups have really different approaches to attack that. You know, if you can't fall asleep, probably the first big step to try is to add like blue light blocking glasses in the evening. There's tons of science that show this, that, you know, there's a sensor in the back of your eye that detects blue light and some green light, and it talks to the SCN of the brain to release melatonin or not release melatonin. Melatonin is the body's natural, drowsy kind of hormone, right? And when there's blue light present, it tells the SCN to not secrete as much melatonin. And then when blue light is not there, it starts putting out melatonin to start you to feel sleepy and all that. And what happens is in today's society with the TVs and iPhones and computer screens and interior lighting is all got, you know, bombarding you with blue light all day and all night. You kind of miss out on that circadian rhythm that happens with the body's own chemistry. And so adding blue light blocking glasses in the evening can allow the body to make its own melatonin and help you fall asleep a lot better. So that's probably one of the big hacks for that.
Yeah.
If you're a female and you're having that 2 a.m. thing where you wake up at 2 a.m. and can't fall back to sleep, that's a lot of time is low progesterone, because what happens is, especially when losing weight, you store excess estrogens, bad estrogens and toxins and things in your fat cells And so when you lose body fat, they get released and sent into the system, and you can end up in this kind of estrogen dominant state because of these are getting dumped into your system as you're losing weight. And that gives you a misbalance with progesterone. And so you end up with low progesterone, and that causes anxiety and sleep issues. So in that case, we just have them do evening primrose oil and then in the evening progest cream to help balance that out.
Oh, is that the Progest E by chance?
Yeah, progesterone cream. It's a wild yam extract.
Oh, got it. Yeah. I was going to say people can actually supplement with the, you know, progesterone, pregnenolone too, which is a precursor. Yeah. It's like main anti-stress hormones that I think, you know, I've personally supplemented with as well. I mean, I not that I'm dealing with the 2 a.m. thing, but that's actually just a general systemic de-stressing hormone that people, I think, can utilize to some good success for health, wellness, fitness.
Yeah, definitely.
I think, so you hit on some great things. I think, you know, people listening at home, you guys should know that I have my own pair of super cool looking blue light stylish glasses that I wear if I'm looking at, you know, watching a TV or something at night here and there. I think that, you know, people can realize that if you're, you know, if you want to go out, obviously, and maybe not look, you know, goofy or whatever, it's more about what you're doing 80% of the time than it is like, hey, like I'm going to go out with friends. Do I have to wear these glasses? So I think that kind of disarms a lot of people from making that healthy habit switch in the first place and say, all right, just, you know, just do it when you're at home, you know, in the privacy of your own home. And I think just to kind of round this out, you know, while we are talking about sleep suggestions, sleep hygiene suggestions, a couple other things you can do is to power down your Wi-Fi at night and not sleep with anything plugged in by the bed. Obviously cutting caffeine, you know, probably early afternoon or mid-afternoon at the latest for the most part. You know, another thing too that I think can help people is to do a bit of carb backloading. And that's where like your daily allotment of carbs, whether it's larger or smaller on that given day, you could have a small, have some of those later on in the day, which actually helps silence some of the stress hormones, which can be good, right? Like cortisol, which can help us focus and kind of actually helps us relax and primes our nervous system and our body before bed. And I think a lot of people tend to do that in reverse.
And you know, what's an interesting hack for that too, is if carbohydrates retain water. And I believe that one of the reasons that works with backloading carbs in the evening for sleep is because you're retaining water and that helps you sleep better during the night. If we have clients all the time that instead of doing that, if they want to stay keto, they just add some salt in the evening. And so they'll take an electrolyte or just even some salt capsules in the evening before bed, and then they sleep great too. So you retain the water just with salt instead of with the carbohydrates. I think that's the key mechanism that's happening there.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, very interesting. I'll have to try both, kind of run a little N=1 experiment. But I think too, there's something to the idea that, you know, we're not like people think of cortisol as this evil stress hormone. But we need it to focus, and, you know, we need it to be alert and awake. Just even at like a resting level, there should be like earlier in the day, at least at like some natural cortisol rhythms that come when you wake up. And I think that, you know, if you're eating, let's say a big, heavy, carby breakfast, like you're like they recommend, like for years in the mainstream, what you'll see happen is you'll kind of not really go in alignment with when your natural stress hormones could be a positive thing, right? And kicking in earlier in the day, let's say when you want to focus for work or read or study or whatever. And then so you kind of give yourself this like big time relaxation bomb of this big, let's say, carb dense meal, and it kind of throws your day off. Whereas I think what would be ideal for the day, for the most part, maybe unless you got a workout early or something like that, is, you know, kind of sticking primarily to like, you know, protein and fats earlier in the day and lower in carbohydrates. And then if you are going to, you know, like I said, have your daily allotment of carbs, it would make more sense that if it's a small amount and you are keto, and you want to time it with your natural wake and sleep cycles, or even if you were, let's say, a person doing a more moderate carb day or diet or something like that, it makes more sense to do that later versus earlier when it's probably going to make you more relaxed and tired.
Yeah, definitely. And the other thing too, that we find supports that natural cycle is to not eat too late in the evening, right? If a lot of people, you know, the bedtime snack right before bed and all that, what happens is, you know, human growth hormone has its highest spike about 2 or 3 hours after you fall asleep. And you want that. That's an important thing to have happen for weight loss, for, you know, in general health and everything. And if you eat too close to bedtime, you know, insulin is kind of competes with human growth hormone. So if insulin's elevated, you're going to suppress human growth hormone, so it can interrupt that natural cycle. So we usually say close the kitchen down, you know, like 3 hours before bed.
Kitchen's closed, guys. Sorry. Yeah. That's funny. So speaking of, you know, I love how you look at health, right? You're like, you know, you have that engineering background. It's like you look at the body as like a fluid editable text, just like a computer program. So you and I were privately talking about something that I think most people at home either might not have heard of or might not know how to get started with. And that's this idea of, you know, short-term protein fasting or short-term protein restricting as part of a fasting protocol. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah, well, we've got a couple ebooks we put out, and we've been for quite a while now been promoting, it's like an alternative to extended fasting that has some of the benefits of weight loss of a longer fast, but doesn't have the negatives, which is, you know, longer, if you fast longer than 24 hours, you'd start to lose lean mass. There's parts of the body, red blood cells and, you know, brain neurons, and there's certain body parts that don't have mitochondria, so they can only run on glucose. And what happens is, if you don't eat anything for more than a day or two, your body has no protein. When you're keto, the body can just take protein and make glucose if it, you know, to supply those body parts. That's what helps you be keto with such a low carb intake. But when you eat nothing, it doesn't have carbs and it doesn't have any protein. So now that its only choice to make glucose is to take your own protein and turn it into glucose. And so you lose that lean mass as you do longer fasts. Protein sparing modified fast is a fast where you have very low carbs and very low fat, but you get your protein goal for the day in for that one day. And then you preserve lean mass. So you get enough protein to preserve your lean mass while keeping energy, carbs and fat, really low. And that just forces your body to tap into more of its own fat for fuel.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And how would you suggest people at home maybe look into this or get started with it if they want? I mean, do you guys put out any information on this where people can kind of, you know, explore if they'd like to dip their toe in?
Yeah, we have on our YouTube channel, we've got a whole bunch of recipes and videos on it. And then, like I mentioned, at keto-adapted.com, we have our Art of Fat Loss and Protein Sparing Modified Fast cookbooks. They're both ebooks with meal plans and everything showing how to do this. But we generally, we say to, you know, implement maybe 1 to 3 days a week of protein sparing days. And then, you know, your regular, whether it's keto weight loss macros or whatever the other days, that makes it kind of more sustainable and approachable for a lot of people. It kind of, you can kind of look at it in that way as, you know, if you're doing like alternate day fasting or something like that, where you're fasting for a day and then you eat the next day. Instead of doing that, add in a couple days a week of protein sparing modified fast, and then you preserve your muscle while losing the weight. And it's just kind of a better alternative in our eyes. The original protocols, you know, going back to bariatric surgery and some of these extreme situations where they were basically, that was their diet after surgery, because when bariatric surgery, you actually need more protein because of absorption issues and all that. So protein sparing modified fast is really good in those situations.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Yeah. I had actually tried a version of a protein fasting diet where like a day a week or something like that. But my protein was pretty in check. Otherwise I was eating quite a bit less protein, and I was really fascinated at some of the results that came through with regards to, leaning out, you know, it seemed like there were some neurological benefits too. And a practitioner had put me on it because in the past I had been following a little bit too much of a high protein diet, which had resulted in like a buildup of things like ammonia and whatnot in my body, unbeknownst to me. And there were some potential neurological consequences there. So it was a very interesting N equals one experiment that I ran.
The name is actually a little, it's hard to understand what it is from the name, because when you say protein sparing, it sounds like you're reducing protein in the diet, but in reality, compared to normal day macros, you're still moderate protein. You're still getting the same protein intake.
Right.
Sparing the protein on your body. You're sparing your body's muscle compared to a long, you know, 48 hour water fast. So that's where the protein you're sparing is your body's protein.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, I've done both in that case then. I was doing a temporary kind of a short-term protein like day fast. And then I've also done, you know, I would say most of what I've done in terms of that kind of work one way or another, up or down, is like what you've been talking about today. So
yeah,
I think that is sort of interesting for people to kind of hear both sides of.
It's an interesting tool and it works extremely well.
Interesting. And now there's a couple other things I want to make sure we hit today, and I want to be respectful of your time too. So on that note, I think a lot of people in the keto community hear one way or another about the carnivore diet, but you know, it sounds weird. It sounds strange. It sounds foreign. It sounds like it's not natural. What are your opinions on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, we wrote a carnivore cookbook and I wrote all the front matter to that book. And one of the first things I started talking about in the beginning was, what's your why? Why do you want to do carnivore? And that can lead to different implementations. One of the reasons to do carnivore, and this has been shown to be pretty effective for a lot of people, is to use it kind of as an ultimate elimination diet. Mm-hmm. And so we actually, in that book, defined a carnivore autoimmune protocol, CAIP. So it's basically, you know, you start out with beef and salt, and then you just kind of work other proteins in. And then eventually, if you want, work other, you know, plants back into your diet and find the food, the triggers for your autoimmune disorder, for, you know, bipolar disease, for, in my case, Lyme disease. I have chronic Lyme disease, and that pain has been greatly alleviated the closer to carnivore I stay. And there's a few different plants that are fine for me, but lots of plants will trigger me to have more pain. And so, you know, it kind of comes down to what's your why, right? If your why is that, then it's a great tool for figuring out, you know, what your body can handle given your conditions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think too, for people that are not necessarily suffering from sort of as severe of an autoimmune condition as Lyme, I've seen carnivore used both in my own experience working with clients and then also in clinical settings. I've seen it get used as almost like a great reset protocol to silence lower level autoimmune issues like a digestive discomfort and bloating, all the way to maybe a little bit of fatigue and things like that. I think, you know, maybe for your average person, using it as like a short-term reset, there can be a lot of value in that before then, as you put, kind of going on some sort of reintroduction diet and slowly but surely including things from other sources, like, you know, fruits, plants, things that are more easily digested. You kind of get to kind of almost test, all right, now that I have a clean slate, is this piece of information, this piece of food, in other words, I'm putting in my body, is the feedback I'm getting from that positive, or am I getting inflammation? Am I having digestive discomfort? And, you know, am I crashing? Like, what's going on here?
Yeah, exactly. You can kind of root out, you know, triggers for yourself and what things don't work well for you. And as far as the, you know, the comment you said about kind of unnatural, one of the things that I put into our book is kind of diving into the research of our ancestors. And so if you go back to our early human ancestors, the Neanderthals and the early humans themselves, there's been a whole bunch of studies now that they look at the collagen in the fossils, and that collagen, the nitrogen content, will tell them how much and what type of protein they were eating. So you can, by the different types of nitrogen groups, you can identify the collagen sources. Was it a plant protein they were eating? Was it a animal protein? What types of animals? All of that. And what they find time and time again is that these early humans, the reason they grew big brains and their guts shrank is because they were primarily eating animal protein. They were eating big herbivores. They were eating woolly mammoths, and were probably the reason woolly mammoths went extinct, because they hunted them out. You know, so you look at it from that perspective, and it's really, you're kind of coming back to what I would consider an evolutionary diet when you are eating primarily protein. And if you look at animal proteins, they are some of the most nutrient dense foods you can eat.
Right.
If you compare them against kale or blueberries or whatever, across the board, just a steak will beat them on vitamins and minerals across a wide range. There's only a couple items, you know, a couple essential vitamins and minerals that kale or blueberries will beat beef on. And so if you want a nutrient dense whole food diet, it's a animal protein focused diet is going to get you the best result.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think even if people are not long-term going to follow carnivore or maybe don't need to, increasing your dietary protein intake for probably 90% of the people listening is going to improve your health. It's going to improve your fitness. It's going to add some lean body mass, help you burn body fat. It's going to help keep you full, right? The satiety level that you get from that benefit-wise is unbelievable. And I think that, you know, the bulk of your diet, at the very least by weight, should be from protein, right? Let's say you eat eggs for people.
Yeah, exactly. And the bioavailability of those vitamins and minerals is another huge component, right? In beef, all the vitamins and minerals are in the most bioavailable form for your body to consume them, right? And absorb them, where a lot of the plant ones are not, you know, like the, was it vitamin A in carrots is the non-active form that the body, you know, it's got to convert to be able to use anyway, where, you know, in animal proteins, it's in the proper form. So, you know, if you look at it from that perspective, it's even more, you know, animal proteins are even more vitamin and mineral superpower.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, your point about bioavailability is important too, because it, how well these things can be, nutrients can be absorbed by the body is incredibly important. And I think a lot of people overlook that.
Not to go too deep down that hole, but another example is like, oxalates, which are an anti-nutrient, which it's a compound in plants that anti-nutrient means the body doesn't need it, doesn't want it, can't do anything with it. So it's got to detox it. And, you know, plants have thousands of these anti-nutrients, but oxalates are one of the big ones that people know about or hear about. Well, things like spinach are very high in oxalates. You know, spinach is really high in calcium too, but guess what? Oxalates, when the body's going to try to detox them, the oxalates will grab onto calcium and magnesium, and they'll leach them from the body as they're being detoxed. So you don't actually absorb in, you know, calcium and magnesium from that food. It just gets leached out of the body. There was a study that looked at oysters, great source of zinc. And they looked at the blood plasma. So they looked at the blood and how much of that mineral got into the blood after you ate oysters. And when you ate the oysters by themselves, there's a big increase in zinc in the blood. So you absorbed all that. When you ate the oysters with black beans, like a third of the zinc got into the body. When you ate the oysters with corn tortilla chips, basically none of the zinc ended up in the body. So, you know, that bioavailability point is even bigger than I think we realize.
Yeah, it's huge. And it sounds like, you know, eating inflammatory foods alongside some of these good quality foods can blunt, you know, that maybe low level autoimmune reaction that inflammation is in the body can actually blunt the absorption of some of these positive things. Yeah. And I think, you know, just kind of like a super quick tidbit, people at home, if you want to feel a lot more energy, if you want to, you know, basically take nature's multivitamin to stay stay healthy and prevent yourself from getting sick if you feel run down, I suggest just having a tin of wild caught oysters, you know, a couple times a week, and you know, making sure you drink the juices in there. I know everybody at home is going to protest about the texture and stuff like that, but I'm telling you, it is an amazing nutrient source. And I think, you know, your point about the plants is well put too. I like, a lot of people look at kale and spinach and think, you know, some of those more thick, heavy cruciferous vegetables, and they're like, oh, the more the merrier. However, you know, humans kind of were more meant to be able to subsist off those things in the absence of things like meat and fruit and stuff like that. If you want to look at it through an evolutionary lens, however, over consuming those, you know, plants like that can actually cause inflammatory reactions, because a lot of that fiber is not well digested, and it's the plant's natural defense mechanism, to prevent, you know, predators, us, other, you know, other animals from eating them. So I think that, kind of moderating that's important.
Yeah. I mean, the plant, if you think about the plant, it doesn't want you to eat its leaves or its stalk or its roots. That kills the plant. So it doesn't want you to eat those parts. It wants you to eat the fruit, you know, to carry the seeds on, but it doesn't want you to eat the other parts. So it's got defenses on those parts. But that's what we tend to look at in, you know, standard American diet, is, you know, unlimited fruits and vegetables because there's no negatives to them. But guess what? There are some negatives. You know, if you're eating, especially if you start concentrating and doing like a kale smoothie, you're getting a huge dose of oxalates that can really be an issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think that's why, like, it is important to look at, like, you know, the idea of the carnivore, you know, protocols, and then say, all right, maybe instead of being black or white and eating is ad libitum as much as we want vegetables and whatnot versus eating none at all, maybe there is a middle ground there where we should all be eating more meat, maybe even more than keto recommends for a lot of people. More protein, and then also at the same time, like, being selective with certain fruits and vegetables that we eat to make sure we're not accidentally making ourselves bloat, kicking off inflammatory responses in the body.
Yeah, definitely.
On that note too, it sounds like you mentioned you supplement with salt a bit. Is there anything else that you're supplementing with at the moment?
And I realize
that you personally could be different than what you recommend to other people.
Yeah, with lime, I'm always trying different things and different stuff. So definitely different. But I would say in general, the biggest thing is just electrolytes. Carbohydrates retain water. And when you cut the carbohydrates, your body's going to release a lot of that water retention, and which is good. But with the water goes the associated electrolytes, the sodium, magnesium, potassium. And so you need to focus on electrolytes even more when you're low carb keto. And on top of that, if you're doing low carb keto the way we would prescribe, which is whole foods based, we're not into the keto products or any of that kind of stuff. We would stick with whole foods. None of those whole foods come with sodium, right? The McDonald's French fries have less sodium than the milkshake. So you're getting sodium everywhere in the standard American diet. Well, if you eat whole foods, you got no sodium coming in unless you add it. And so you have to be, you know, mindful about adding sodium and taking electrolytes. We do magnesium as well, because I think some of the studies I've seen, like over 80% of Americans are deficient in magnesium. We used to get it in our water and in the topsoils, but they're depleted and, you know, all the water's filtered and all that. So, everybody, I think, can be good to add a magnesium supplement, regardless of diet.
Absolutely.
So those two for sure. Those are just electrolytes in general. Beyond that, you know, we take basically like we ancestral supplements, makes these beef organs, which if you want to talk about the real powerhouse, you know, in nutrients, organ meats are off the charts.
Yeah, absolutely.
Beef liver, but the beef organs is kind of like our bioavailable multivitamin that we take. And so we take that. Those are the big ones. I also take a K2 just because I don't eat as much fresh organ meats as I should. That's where you usually get K2, or in a plant world, mm-hmm. K2 from naturally fermented vegetables. primarily, and most people don't naturally ferment anything anymore. It's like the lacto fermented kind of, you know, fermentation. And so vitamin K2 is really, it regulates calcium metabolism. It gets the calcium where you want it in the bones and keeps it out of your arteries or kidney stones and all of that. So I think K2 is a good one for most people as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, actually, at Real Ketones, the chief science officer, Gary Millett, actually helped, speaking of electrolytes, and you know, of course, K2 and vitamins and minerals, you know, he made a keto-specific multivitamin and make sure that if they're making, you know, if they're coming out with a formulation, it's all encased in electrolytes, right? And so yeah, you know, that's that whole concept of, all right, what do we need if we are going to make this step into this diet? Like, how can we make that as easy as possible on the body? And then habitually, habit-wise, how can we make that as easy as possible on the user? So he, you know, when you talk about getting, you know, nutrient density in the form of things like, you know, the beef organs, glandulars, things like that, K2, electrolytes, you know, that was something that I think that was really useful to help formulate that almost like keto, a keto specific multivitamin.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense.
On that note too, have you had any experience with any, you know, I know we're mainly talking health and wellness today. Have you had any experience with exogenous ketones as well?
You know, the primary areas that we've used or recommended them is Alzheimer's and, you know, those kind of brain type of issues where the ketones can supply fuel that maybe the brain is resistant to with glucose, which is primarily what Alzheimer's is. That's the primary area that we have used them.
Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah. I was curious what you thought. I mean, especially with all the research out there now that it's almost looking at exogenous ketones like you would like a superfood, but for the brain. And it's almost like, you know, you look at various areas, like now we can see it improves reaction time by as much as 10%. You know, subjectively, people have found that it can reduce their anxiety quite a bit as well in other research, right? Like as much as 40% in one study. And I think also just, you know, the positive outcomes that we're seeing in neurodegeneration, you know, even people who don't have that, right, in cognitive enhancement and focus, it makes a strong case for fuel preferences of ketones to the brain, right?
Yeah, sorry, I was on mute there. You know that the brain loves ketones, and what I was describing earlier about the baby has those high ketones because the brain likes them. There's actually some studies, and one I put in our book that talked about the one of the key roles that ketones play in brain neuron development at that age in newborns. The brain is, I personally think that the brain prefers to run on ketones than glucose.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the order that it's metabolized in too, I mean, it's like, gimme, you know, not just the brain, but, you know, the sort of systemically. I think, you know, in another conversation with that same, you know, scientist, researcher, Gary Millett, that I was talking about, he said something that always has stuck with me since, and that's that, you know, with regards to you guys recommending the exogenous ketones for, you know, we'll call it people with conditions as well, or people who might have, you know, something going on. I think the one commonality across all of those is decreased energy metabolism in your cells, aka less energy to go around to fuel these other things. And for some people, it might show up as, you know, a some sort of neurodegenerative disease. For other people, it might show up as like a hormonal insufficiency. Like how it shows up can be different, but at the root cause, there's all like a lack of energy in the cells or the mitochondria, if you want to get nerdy with it. And so what's nice about the exogenous ketones too is as you're getting people's energy systems back online through things like sleep, diet, and really figuring that out, you know, supplementation, these are a way to provide like top off the energy systems in a way that, you know, doesn't tax the adrenal glands. And you basically are just almost like handing a baton to your cells to literally make more energy with the fuel everything else we do, from thinking all the way to muscle firing. Let's see here. And so in addition to that, too, the one last thing I wanted to ask you here, again, just you've been more than generous with your time, is basically where people can find more of your books, where people can find more of, you know, your information, and how they can connect with you on social media if they do want to learn more.
Yeah, you know, it's either Maria Emmerich or Craig Emmerich on most social media. On Facebook, we also have a keto group, a carnivore group, 30-day cleanse group for that specific cookbook. And then there's also a sugar-free kids group. So lots of areas there where people can connect with us and get, you know, communities of support. For us, we have a free blog at mariamindbodyhealth.com.
Yep.
And a support website where you can get some support subscriptions and buy our eBooks and all that at keto-adapted.com. Or you can just find all this through ketomaria.com, where we've got links to kind of everything.
Okay, that's awesome. And you guys have a couple books coming out with, and have had a couple books come out with, Halle Berry too, right? What are the names of some of your guys' books, if we can, you know, if that way people can, you know, if they want to read more, they can.
Definitely, you know, mostly on Amazon for all the published books. The Sugar-Free Kids is coming out at the end of August. Halle Berry is writing the foreword for that, so we're pretty excited about that. It's for our first book, actually collaborating with her, so we're pretty excited.
Very nice. Okay, that's great. And I'll be sure to include links in the show notes so that everyone can check out your books, check out your guys' work. And I love that you have simple guides and you know, again, a bunch of free information for people to check out to learn about some of these things we talked about today for themselves, whether it's, you know, supplementation, the carnivore diet, you know, a bit of the Dr. Stephen Gundry work and how plants could potentially be inflammatory, you know, sugar-free kids, so on and so forth.
Yeah, we kind of try to look at it from a holistic perspective of health. So lots of different areas to dive into there for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, what's nice is that you guys help distill that into something simple, actionable, and pragmatic for everybody, which is, you know, really, really why we had started this show, was to make this information accessible to everyone, kind of, you know, distill any potential complex science into simple understanding. So, you know, thank you for coming on and helping us do that today.
I appreciate it, Matt. Thank you.
Absolutely. All right, everyone. I loved interviewing Craig. I loved interviewing Maria as well. I can't wait for you guys to dive in and get to know this power couple like I have. And once again, thank you, everyone, for inviting us into your home for another exciting episode of BHB Radio. Till next time.